Today is September the 9th, 2020.
It's time for the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcast of the program is available on prn.fm on the Internet as well as pcradioshow.org. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday, it's 6 p.m. Eastern Time, and the number is 641-793-7091. You can leave me a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. Amazon has a new feature that may be a privacy issue. Amazon's announcement that it's adding a new service to Alexa for landlords. It's called Alexa for Residential. That, according to Amazon, makes it easy for property managers to set up and manage Alexa-powered smart home experiences throughout their buildings. Landlord can set special Alexa commands that will let their residents pay rent, submit maintenance requests, and manage other things that normally come with the territory of renting an apartment or other dwelling. And, of course, it will still function as a regular smart speaker. Dim the lights and get weather report. Landlords can also remotely reset the device whenever someone moves out to give the device a clean slate for the next renter. Amazon claims in its press release that it's taken the steps necessary to protect the privacy of residents. This just one issue that Amazon did not address in its announcement, the drop-in feature, which is a feature on Amazon Echo devices. Drop-in allows one Echo user to connect to another user's device, as long as that user can grant them permission. They don't even need to be in the same household, as long as both devices are connected to the Internet. Drop-in functions like a Zoom call. With this feature enabled, you will be able to hear anything within the range of the device, see anything on the other side, and in the case of an Echo Show, and also transmit your voice or video feed to the other device. According to Amazon, the drop-in feature has safeguards in place, and they imply that this potential privacy-invading feature is entirely in a tenant's control. Drop-in will only work if a resident links their in-unit device to their Amazon account. Once they've linked their account, they'll be able to use all the features Alexa has to offer, including drop-in for contacts who have granted permission. For example, your landlord could connect their own account to your device, giving them control over the drop-in feature. As long as the device is not in Do Not Disturb mode, their call will connect, which is especially problematic if you're not home and Do Not Disturb mode is off. There are no laws that treat this in the same vein as physically entering your home without permission. The landlord would be able to hear or, and if the device is in an Echo Show, look into your home. Your home that you're paying rent for, which should afford you privacy from remote viewing. A lot of landlords and property management companies also require periodic physical inspections of your home, generally to make sure that you're keeping the place in a habitable state, or if they suspect you're violating your lease for any reason, they generally still have to get your permission to enter. But if your unit comes with an Echo Show, they could require you to enable the drop-in feature to see inside your home without having to physically be present. There's nothing from stopping landlords from putting a stipulation in the lease that residents have to have drop-in enabled. Sure, that's like a legal battle waiting to happen. But someone's privacy has to be violated first, so it's no less a problem at the moment. In a study by the National Apartment Association, which says 84% of renters want an apartment with smart home amenities, and 61% of whom say they would pay a monthly fee for a voice assistant as part of its justification for offering its new Alexa for Residential service. First of all, Who is this 84% of the people who would say okay with their landlord having access to their smart speaker in their home? Never mind the possibility that employees at Amazon could be listening to a recording of whenever you pay your rent. Amazon says that property managers will not have access to any customer data, and voice recordings are automatically deleted daily. Residents would also be able to connect their personal Amazon account to the device and control their privacy settings. Still, having a landlord-owned smart speaker or even a personal smart speaker in your home should not be acceptable to almost everyone. Who wants to tack on an additional amount to their already monthly bill? In 2018, Amazon teamed up with Zego to roll out Alexa smart home devices to 30,000 apartments. Given enough time and demand, the landlord may want to put an Alexa device in your home, to which, of course, the first question I would ask is, do I have to use it? And if I don't, that sucker is getting dismantled and put in a box in my closet if my landlord won't remove it from my home. But if it's in the lease, you have to comply with it. Let me count how many ways your privacy can be invaded. Have you thought about getting cable TV channels and 4K from an antenna rather than use the internet? It's rolling out to this U.S. city for $49. When it comes to cord cutting, the one constant to streaming TV service is access to the internet is required. Cable companies have raised costs of the internet as they lose cable TV subscribers. What if you can get TV channels and 4K from an antenna? Boise, Idaho is the first to get Evoca, that's EVOCA, a new kind of pay TV service broadcast over the air. Today, there are basically three ways to get live TV shows from big name channels into your home. The most common is paying for a service like cable or satellite. An increasing popular alternative is a live TV streaming service like Sling TV and YouTube TV, which offers hundreds of channels for a monthly fee. The third option is free, and it also sounds most old-fashioned. Getting an over-the-air antenna and watching channels broadcast in your area. Now a company in Idaho is launching a fourth live TV option that's especially interesting for anyone with limited or data cap internet where streaming isn't an option. It's called Evoca. EVOCA. It takes advantage of the new technologies rolling out with the next-gen TV to broadcast cable channels over the air. It's designed to serve people in the many smaller cities and rural areas across the U.S. saddled with mediocre and expensive broadband internet. Evoca started rolling out this week in Boise, Idaho, but it's hoping to have the service available in other markets soon. It currently offers over 60 channels of sports, news, and other entertainment for $50 a month. And here's how it works. Many stations across the United States will start broadcasting a next-gen TV, formerly known as ATSC 3.0. It's a huge leap forward in tech compared with the current ATSC 2.0 broadcast, standard for HDTV, almost big as the leap from fuzzy analog TV signals to HDTV itself. The headline feature for next-gen TV are 4K resolution, HDR, and potentially higher frame rates. We might eventually get the ability to watch live broadcast TV on phones and tablets too. One of the more obscure but important features is the fact that it's IP-based. That means it's kind of like streaming video just sent over the air instead of cable wires. This has several benefits. Many Americans live in big cities with access to fast home internet, numerous broadcast stations, and multiple TV providers. But in smaller cities, not only are there fewer broadcasters, but the high-speed internet could be slow or have data caps. Both of these things mean that cutting the cord by giving up an overpriced cable service isn't all that easy. Over-the-air content might be limited, and streaming TV either doesn't work or cost too much, or both. With Everco's service, Edge Networks wants to be like other TV providers, offering a slate of channels for a monthly fee. Instead of running wires to your house, it'll use next-gen TV's tech to broadcast those same channels over the air. This sadly doesn't mean that everyone in Boise with a next-gen TV-capable television will have free HBO. Edge Networks customers get a special tuna box similar to a cable box that decodes the broadcast. The difference is that the last mile from the provider to the house is the airwaves. In addition to the Everco tuna box, all a potential customer needs to get started is an antenna and an internet connection, and it could be a relatively slow one for downloading optional video on demand content. The box will give a single point of access, functioning as a tuner for next-gen TV and other local broadcast channels, plus the various cable channels and specific video on demand content. The Everco Scout Tuner connects to an antenna, your TV, and the internet for $49 a month, and no fast internet is required. Everco is still in early rollout stages, and its initial goal is to boost the current 60-channel selection to over 80 channels in HD and 4K. The $49 monthly fee is in line with the competition. By way of comparison, the most expensive live TV streaming service, YouTube TV, costs $65 a month for more than 70 channels, but it requires a decent internet connection, especially if you want HD resolution or to stream more than one show at once. With Everco, there shouldn't be a bandwidth issues in the home when watching multiple streams, HD or even 4K video, since the signal isn't relying on the speed of an internet connection. This is useful for anyone without a super fast internet connection, but especially so for people with speeds that might not support 4K at all. Netflix requires 25 megabits per second to stream in 4K. For example, Everco recommends a minimum speed of only 5 megabits per second. The niche for Edge Networks is in smaller markets that are underserved by internet providers and by cable broadcast. Many communities are in so-called TV deserts, where there are few, if any, local broadcast stations. These areas often also have poor internet for streaming. NextGen TV, with its more efficient HEVC compression, opens up possibilities like this for high quality and more variant content. It's unlikely Everco will expand to larger markets where internet is generally cheaper, faster, and lacks data caps, at least for now. In those markets, cutting the cord usually just means getting an antenna and or streaming everything not broadcast. Like all antenna TV, Everco is a local endeavor, but after Boise Edge Networks intends to expand to other similarly sized markets in the future, $49 is technically below the $50 it promised, and initial signups will only have to pay $20 a month for the rest of the year, plus they'll get a free antenna. For the rest of us, how well Everco does might have some influence on offerings in other larger markets. Perhaps more stations might see this as a way to offer a wider variety of content in new ways, just on a smaller scale than a full cable TV package.
Working remotely in the pandemic may generate a tax surprise for you. Working remotely may generate a tax surprise if the pandemic caused you to relocate across state lines, even temporarily. The next surprise could be having to file an extra tax return and potentially pay more taxes. The issue gained national attention back in May when Governor Andrew Cuomo of New York said out-of-state health care workers who came to help with the pandemic would face New York income taxes. Cuomo's comment generated outrage, but in fact, most states tax people who earn money within their borders, even if those people usually live and file tax returns elsewhere. Even a single day in some states can trigger a tax bill. Remote working could mean tax hassles.
Multi-state taxation has long been a headache for entertainers, athletes, professional speakers, and others who earn money in more than one state. Snowbirds, retirees, who move south for the winter, can face it as well. Now it could be a problem for many people who relocated, however temporarily, because of the pandemic. Nearly 1 in 10 young adults, those ages 18 to 29, said they had relocated because of a pandemic, according to a Pew Research survey poll taken in early June. Overall, 3% of adults said they moved, and 6% said someone else had moved into their households. Those who moved, citing reducing their risk of infection, 28%. College campuses closing, 23%. Wanting to be with a family, 20%. And job loss or other financial issues, 18%. Changing attitudes about remote work means that multi-state taxation could be an issue for more people and companies in the future. Nearly half of the company leaders surveyed by research firm Gartner in June said they plan to let employees work remotely, full-time, even after people can return to the workplace. Remote working allows people to move to more affordable areas, which could be in a different state. But having even a single employee in another state can raise business and sales taxes to their companies. For individuals, double taxation. Having to pay taxes in two or more states on the same income is possible because state rules differ so widely. In most cases, though, the taxpayer's home state will offer credit for taxes paid in other states. But there are scenarios where someone could end up paying more without technically being taxed twice. If the tax rate in a new location is higher, for example, the home state credit may not offset the whole bill. Also, if the person's home state doesn't impose an income tax, but the other state does, then there's no credit to offset the additional taxes. There's another issue. Failing to file a required state tax return, either because people didn't know the other state required it, or because they're hoping to get away with it, that could lead to audits, taxes, penalties, and amended returns. Auditors often configure where you were when by using cell phone records and credit card receipts. You can, of course, decide to make your move permanent, but if you change your mind, move back and get audited, the auditors will conclude that you never truly left. What can be done? Some states have long-standing reciprocity agreements, usually with neighboring states, that will prevent commuters from having to file multiple state tax returns. In addition, 13 of the 41 states that tax income have said they will give remote workers a break if they moved because of the coronavirus. People who may be affected by another state tax laws talk to a tax pro to assess what their liability might be and discuss the situation with the employer. In case their withholding needs a change, keep good records so you can track how many days you earn money in each state and how much. Those ideas may face opposition from states desperate to replace lost revenue. However, the lockdowns quash economic activity and the resulting recession has made consumers and businesses cautious about spending money, further reducing tax revenues. The states need money. Because of COVID, they need more money than ever before. And, of course, the states know very well how to tax. The National Security Agency's program to collect details on billions of domestic phone calls and text messages in the United States was illegal in a federal appeals court ruling and was probably an unconstitutional abuse of power. The findings were unanimously handed down in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals case concerning the 2013 conviction of four Somali immigrants of fundraising for terrorist organizations, which involved bulk data collected by the NSA and has taken most of the last decade to resolve. The court found that the metadata did not play a significant role in the case and upheld the convictions of the three co-defendants. However, that the NSA's indiscriminate harvesting of phone records violated the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which is also known as FISA, as well as hinted that it was unconstitutional. The NSA's bulk collection of phone records was one of the intelligence program's former CIA contractor Edward Snowden leaked to the media in 2013, showing that top U.S. intelligence officials had lied to the public that the NSA hadn't been stockpiling data on Americans at all. For the duration of the program, the NSA obtained extensive records from telecommunications companies like Verizon, including metadata such as call location and duration, the numbers of the parties involved. The NSA also had access to text messages metadata, such as the number of characters in a text. When paired with other information, the metadata would be quite revealing to the behavior and habits of targeted individuals. The Department of Justice argued in the case decided that such collection did not amount to a search because those targeted implicitly agreed to share data with providers. The judge shut down the argument, agreeing with the 2015 ruling that the mass surveillance wasn't actually tied to specific investigations. The judge also found the government withheld the information about the source of its metadata from the defendants. At its height, the agency was harvesting billions of entries a day. The 2015 U.S. Freedom of Act killed the program, but the NSA didn't stop collecting data. It was simply required to submit specific queries rather than suck up everything by default. The Freedom Act, however, also allowed the NSA to request metadata from anyone a targeted individual had been in contact with, allowing it to collect over 34 million U.S. calls and tax records from just 42 targets in 2017 alone. In 2019, it was reported the NSA had discovered major problems with the data provided by telecom companies and had grown cold to the program's operational value, largely discontinuing it. Director of National Intelligence urged Congress last year, when the Freedom Act was set to expire, to renew its Section 215 powers authorizing bulk collection. Congress extended those powers through March 2020, but it had been too distracted by other crises to pass a revised version of the Freedom Act, which would ban the practice entirely. That extension expired in March, stripping the NSA of its Section 215 playbook. The federal government claimed the program was vital in stopping 54 terrorist attacks, which was later revealed to be a bunch of hogwash. From 2015 to 2019, the Freedom Act version of the program only started one significant investigation. Congressional investigations have whittled down those 54 supposed cases to just one named individual. Based on their careful review of the classified record, they were satisfied that any lack of notice, assuming such notice was required, did not prejudice the defendants. The judge also wrote, having carefully reviewed the classified FISA application and all related classified information, they were convinced that under established Fourth Amendment standards, the metadata collection, even if unconstitutional, did not taint the evidence introduced by the government at trial. The defendants could still call for an 11-judge session to review the 3-judge opinion. They could also petition the Supreme Court to hear an appeal. The ruling makes plain that the NSA bulk collection of Americans' phone records violated the Constitution. The decision also recognizes that when the government seeks to prosecute a person, it must give notice of the secret surveillance it used to gather its evidence. The NSA's bulk collection of phone records was one of the intelligence program's former CIA contractor Edward Snowden leaked to the media in 2013, showing that top U.S. intelligence officials had lied to the public that the NSA hadn't been stockpiling data on Americans at all. In this particular case, the fact that it took this long to process this case and the justice ruling was finally given, it is an injustice that it's taken this long. It's really justice denied.
Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with his IT Pro Series. Remote management and monitoring.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now is when we get down to business. This is where I talk about some of the different things that go on within the world of the IT professional. One of the things that comes up on a regular basis is, hey, how do you guys know all this? How do you guys do this or that? And I'll get to this. And one of the big ones is, how do you monitor hundreds and hundreds of servers? Now, what I'm going to be talking about is remote monitoring and management tools, or RMM. And there are a number of different packages that are out there. They compete against each other, and they're all competing to see who can spy on the servers and desktops better than the other ones. Now, I've used a number of these over the years. I'm going to name off just a few different names. One of them is Pulseway. Another one is SolarWinds. There's Ninja RMM. And then there's Paisler PRTG. And I'm not sure I'm pronouncing Paisler right, but there you go. And you may have heard of GoToMyPC or GoToMeeting. And, you know, a number of these different companies have a number of different ways that they reach into computers and manage them. And the list is huge. The list is very long and includes AnyDesk and ConnectWise and Komodo One and Continuum. There's a ton of them out there. So what they're doing is they are latching into the computer. But they're latching into some of the different things that are built into Windows and also into the Mac operating system and into the different other devices that you might connect to the network. For instance, you connect up an Android phone, you connect up your iPhone or your iPad or whatever it is that you connect up to the business network, and the business network can actually detect it. And it can find out a number of things about it. Depending on which operating system, what type of device it is, it can get actually down to a lot of the nitty-gritty. For instance, one of the things that I used to use, I used a company called Spiceworks. And, don't worry about the different software packages. There's a ton of them out there. But this Spiceworks package happened to do just an amazing amount of inventory of the hardware and the software. To what extent? It could look up, if we connected up the right computer to the network, a Windows computer, it could find out what the brand name was. Great. What the hardware was, great. It could find out the system ID, look up the system ID on, I'm going to give an example. It could look up and find out that it was a Dell. It could find out that the Dell was purchased a matter of 2.5 years ago, and its warranty expiration is in 6 months, and it also has this software package, this software package, this software package, and this software package. It has these different Windows updates on it. It's missing these other ones. There's an incompatibility between this and that. It can also monitor, when was the last time the computer was turned off? When was it turned on? Who's logging into the system? What kind of rights do they have to the system? And it continues on and on and on. I'm only scratching the surface of some of the things that it could do. Now, different packages work out differently. Different packages are better geared for monitoring an entire network. SolarWinds is really good at that. It monitors the network and it's following along with a lot of the routers and a lot of the different switches. It's following along a lot of the paths that go throughout the network. It tracks all of the servers and desktops too. But the goal is to find out what is disrupting the network, what is creating a problem for you and or your network team out there. And it is really going to a brand new level of finding out what's there. Each of these has their own different strengths and weaknesses. So another program that I used for a while was it was Pulseway. And Pulseway was neat in that it could monitor the systems. You would load in a little program onto the operating system, just a little service, and it would alert you remotely. It could, that was how they got through the firewall. They loaded on this this software package, which would then send out something to the internet and say, hey, I'm rebooting the system right now. Oh, you want me to reboot it again via remote? Oh, you want me to lock the screen? You want me to do this, that, or the other thing? So I used that a lot when I worked for a particular company a while back, and that was how I managed to do reboots of the hardware during the middle of the night because I wasn't going to drive in. I could program them. I could say, hey, you're going to reboot tonight at 3 o'clock in the morning. And that's perfectly fine, but it was nice to be able to do a number of the different functions via remote from anywhere I was. I could do it on vacation, except I'd be working on vacation. That's one of the downsides. And I'll talk about that in a future show. One of the downsides of being in IT is you are technically on call 24/8, 25/8, whatever it is. You're on call all the time. Even if you're in a group that's covered by a lot of people, you usually have some kind of well, that's another story for another day. We'll get into that. But the RMM software, that remote monitoring and management tool, yeah, that's something that's all over the place. And they can check so many different things. It's got so much power. But I hope you learned a little bit of something here today. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Of course, back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. The H-1B visa program needs an overhaul. The H-1B Foreign Worker Visa Program is one of America's programs for recruiting the best and the brightest foreign workers. The H-1B visa program is, in theory, serving a useful purpose, but in practice, the program does not work properly. The H-1B visa program does not work properly because you have to apply in April for a job opening that can only start in October of the same year, and not sooner unless you're applying for a cap-exempt position. There's a limit of 85,000 H-1B visas per year, even though there is almost double that number of applicants applying every year. To sort this out, the government runs a yearly lottery, so the employer needs to win the H-1B visa lottery to be able to offer you the job. You have to have three separate government approvals involving the Department of Labor for the Employer's Labor Condition Application, that's the LCA, establishing that the job offered is paying at least the prevailing wage rate for workers doing that work in the same area and that there is no labor unrest at the employing organization. Next, the Department of Homeland Security to get the approval of the employer's petition and the terms of employment, including the lottery component. And the Department of Secretary of State to establish an overseas U.S. consulate that you, as the applicant, meet the requirements posted by the employer in terms of education and experience to get the work visa. Canadians are exempted from this step and are dealt with at the border. That's a lot of paperwork and much overlap. For many employers and applicants, the paperwork and effort involved requires a degree of accuracy and stress that it really isn't worth the result. The cost of preparing the application and the work and frustrations involved are significant. Not everyone has the stomach for it. Cap-exempt H-1B visas. If you get a job offered from a cap-exempt employer, you are exempt from the 85,000 maximum visa cap restrictions per year. The exemption applies to institutions of higher learning such as universities and colleges, nonprofit entities related to or affiliated with such high education organizations, nonprofit research organizations or government research agencies, and organizations that require H-1B workers to work at one of the above organizations. Such applicants do not need to win the lottery and can apply directly for their visa. Nonetheless, even here, the effort and cost of getting approval is substantial. Despite these shortcomings, the H-1B visa is critical to the United States and many would-be immigrants. The traditional and most common path for immigrants is F-1 student visa to optional practical training, that's OPT, for 1 year following graduation, to H-1B visa for up to 7 years or more if a permanent resident application is filed, to green card to U.S. citizenship. The process can take as much as a decade or longer to complete to get to permanent residence, followed by 5 years more to get citizenship. This is an ambitious program that many foreign young students embark upon, their pursuit of the American dream. The COVID-19 pandemic has negatively impacted the H-1B visa program. For one thing, due to the high number of Americans who have lost work and are now unemployed, there is a lot of pressure on the federal government to close the door on foreign workers on the argument that they are taking jobs away from American workers. The argument goes that these foreign workers are being paid lower wages, and that is the reason the tech industry, in particular among them, is so insistent to need and leave the program intact. The result has been that President Trump recently implemented a freeze on granting H-1B visas to applicants overseas until the end of this year. In this regard, it's worthwhile to consider a few factors at play in this immigration area. As reported in a previous broadcast on this show, there are three facts that seem to be contrary to public perception. According to the Department of Labor, the median salary of the H-1B worker is significantly higher than the American median salary. The education level of 1 in 4 H-1B worker is no higher than a bachelor degree and in many cases just an associate degree or high school degree. There are many documented cases in which American worker is replaced by an H-1B worker, and to qualify for severance pay, they are required to train their replacement. As reported in the New York Times, in 2015, Disney got hit with two class action suits. Walt Disney World Orlando was charged with illegally replacing workers by foreign workers in their IT jobs at Walt Disney World in Orlando in January 2015. Workers were told they had 90 days to train their replacements. Foreigners on H-1B visas, the most common visa for high-skilled foreign workers, and if they didn't agree, the laid-off workers weren't eligible for bonuses or severance packages. Up to 300 workers also lost their jobs. The lawsuits filed in the Tampa federal court charged Disney and two global consulting companies, HCL and Cognizant, for colluding to break the law. Both HCL and Cognizant are outsourcing companies known for submitting a high volume of H-1B positions each year. By law, H-1B workers can't replace American workers, and the suit alleges that's exactly what the three companies did. Disney is not the only company using outsourcing companies to hire immigrants to replace American workers, but they're one of the first to be caught. Typically, companies require employees to sign a severance agreement, preventing them from suing or speaking out about the firm. Some companies will offer as much as $20,000. Disney didn't do that. They failed to put the "you can't sue" and "you can't talk" clause in their severance package. Eventually, more than 100 of the workers affected by the changes were rehired. Disney said it done nothing wrong. In effect, many companies were hiring H-1B workers, replacing their American counterparts, in which the functional requirements were met with a lower-level job description. In effect, the companies needed not a highly skilled worker, but a lower-skilled level to do the job. To say the H-1B program was designed to hire highly skilled workers that were not available was no longer the rationale. It's important to note that there are strict quotas of H-1B every year, and outsourcing companies snatch up these visas, and it takes away opportunities for other firms that really do need the expertise of foreign tech workers in their company. Like many programs, the original mission or intent disappeared as participants learn how to game the system. Google Maps quietly rolled out one of its most requested features. Google Maps has added a new feature to its app traffic lights at intersection in a number of U.S. cities. This tech company made a change to help people stay better informed on the road. The new road icons are visible in the app at intersections throughout the United States on both Android and iOS. Google's update includes a color mapping algorithm technique to help users more easily identify varying terrain types such as beaches and forests.
The Google Maps redesign also will include redrawings of sidewalks and pedestrian islands for better navigation viewing. The feature showing traffic lights at intersections had previously been available on Google Maps in Japan for years, according to the company, but it has been among its most requested feature in the United States. Earlier this year, Google Maps began testing the traffic lights feature in select cities throughout the United States. Google releases a new Android Auto update. Google has just shipped a new Android Auto update, and the company did not share with the public with what's been improved in this release. The new Android Auto version is 5.6.6034, and it comes exactly 1 month after version 5.5.6029. There's no major new feature that one can easily spot in this new version. This new update could also bring other improvements and optimization, and as it typically happens when Google rolls out such a mysterious update, we'll find out more about it, what's new in Android Auto 5.6 in the coming days as more people install it. One thing for sure though, Google will not win awards for documentation. Presenting Marty Winston with Home Automation. What wiring teaches us about plumbing.
I remember that in my younger days, more or less in the middle of all the places a young man could go at night to watch single young women drinking and flirting, there was a place with a large and well-tended lawn and landscaping and sizable multi-story buildings. It was a university, and like most universities, there was a remarkable library there. This was before I enlisted in the Air Force, before I switched to a radio TV broadcasting major from a four-way major minor parlay in creative writing, English, secondary education, and psychology. At that early time, I was a double E major, electrical engineering. I had made the mistake of confusing electrical engineering, which was a lot of graphing and numerics and not a lot of hands-on, for electronics, which I started enjoying a decade earlier and still do today. I was a voracious reader of the newsstand electronic hobby magazines. 10 years later, I was writing for most of them. That includes the ham radio magazines. And that campus library had electronics and ham radio magazines going back to what's now about a century ago. There were lots of explanations about the basics of electricity and electronics, and many of those made plumbing a metaphor. They would tell you that a voltage is like water pressure and current like the water flow, and as for resistance, that was too small a pipe or some other blockage. Let's go the other way. Back then, plumbing was more familiar than electricity. These days, for a lot of people, electricity is more familiar than plumbing. Maybe you're in the middle. That's fine. Maybe you're a professional plumber or plumbing contractor. Also, fine. This is turf that's unlikely to come to mind for most people. It's about what wiring teaches us about plumbing. Yeah, that's a little backwards. What wiring teaches us about plumbing? It doesn't even have to be power wiring, but that's an okay place to start. The wiring in your walls, the NM cables, NM stands for non-metallic, meaning the cables that everybody who buys and uses just call Romex, but that only Southwire can sell as Romex because they own the trademark. Well, wiring, like water pipes, comes in different diameters. Pipes pass water. Wires pass, well, might as well call it juice, electrical current. The thing that gets measured in amps. A lot of household wiring uses 14-gauge wire, which is rated to handle 15 amps maximum and isn't allowed to connect to a breaker any bigger than 15 amps. By the way, it's recommended never to put more than 12 amps on it. 80% is the rule. Some household wiring needs to carry more amperage, and thicker 12-gauge wiring is rated 20 amps. Don't exceed 16. 20 is its absolute limit. And that 12-gauge wire can connect to a 20-amp breaker. The more current you want to flow along a wire, meaning the more amps you want it to deliver, the bigger the wire you need. And the more water you want to flow through a pipe, the bigger the pipe you need. Pattern. You might see quarter-inch lines feeding, a refrigerator's indoor ice maker or a whole house humidifier, but that's about it. You might see half-inch pipe feeding a single point of use, like a spigot. You're more likely to see three-quarter-inch or one-inch pipes. And the water mains, or the pipe coming from a well pump, are likely to be even bigger, just as 200-amp or 400-amp power mains are bigger than the Romex in your walls. So lesson number one, the more you need to flow, the larger the diameter of what it should be flowing through. Ready for lesson one and a half? You may remember that with only a very few exceptions, all our updated wiring here uses 12-gauge Romex, even where it's only connecting to 15-amp outlets. It costs a little more, but not that much. And there are other benefits. Wiring has a rating that most people ignore. Resistance per foot. The bigger the cable, the less, the lower the resistance. For any given amount of current you put on a wire, some of it goes into overcoming that resistance, which results in a small voltage drop. With a lot of demand and a distant outlet, that voltage drop becomes a concern, but it's not the biggest concern. The bigger concern is that resistance wiring is how they make space heaters and toasters. And the amount of power that gets turned into heat increases not just with amperage, it's the square of the amperage. If you want to shave the voltage and power losses, you have two choices. Either use a bigger wire or split the feed into separate circuits, each carrying less current. And that is lesson number one and a half for plumbing. If you can't get enough water flow to everything you have down one pipe, either replace it with a bigger pipe or run a second pipe and split it into two feeds. That assumes, of course, that you have enough water pressure to begin with, but increasing that, well, it almost always starts with calling the plumber or the well company. Back to the wires, and with this one, be careful. This is not, well, it may not be, probably isn't a good do-it-yourself exercise. How solid are the connections? Any chance they've rusted or corroded? How old are the breakers? Spot checking the voltage at outlets around the house can give you some answers, but it comes down to this. Bad connections add resistance. They can heat up, and they may cause fires. The flow of electricity serves you best if it's unimpeded. And that is lesson number two for plumbing. Keep your pipes clean. Don't let scale form. Make sure faucets have good gaskets. Don't add flow to where you need the water to go. Well, enough about power wiring. Let's talk about analog signals like on antenna or cable TV feeds. From the point where that signal originates to the other end of that wire where you want to use it, like your TV set, you get better results if you don't let that signal weaken and don't let outside electronic noise get into it. When you want that to happen for electronic signals, you use coaxial cables. More of the signal you start with gets through and less of what's around the wire gets in. Which is exactly what you do to protect the temperature of hot or cold water in pipes. You separate them from ambient space using foam, so hot stays hotter longer and doesn't cool as quickly, and cold stays cooler longer. That thermally insulating foam, well, it's not expensive, and it is fast and easy to add. And lesson number three for plumbing is to add insulation to exposed pipes so their version of signal, temperature, gets delivered with less degradation. One more step, network wiring. Some of you may already be familiar with the term topology. It refers to the shape of the network, the routes that data has to follow to get from something at point A to something at point B. In terms of the plumbing parallel, consider point A to be the water main coming into the house and point B to be the fixture where you want water to come out. Real-world plumbing tends to follow one of three protocols, and some of the same terms apply to those shapes in both network wiring and water pipes. There's branching, where bigger trunk pipes branch off to slightly smaller distribution pipes, and those may branch off to smaller still endpoint connection pipes. Branching works a lot like networks that go through multiple Ethernet switches. There's what's called a home run topology, where every endpoint, every faucet, every toilet, and so on, everyone gets a direct connection back to a master distribution manifold. No connections midway. That's a lot like a star topology network, or one where the first switch has extra bandwidth and every connection comes to only that switch. Then there's the hybrid. It's less organized than either. It might start at a master distribution manifold, but somewhere downstream, it will have junctions where multiple endpoint feeds tap in. Not a home run unless your home runs always come with detours. Trunking technologies are easier to maintain, and from what real-world street-smart plumbers tell us, a lot less likely to fail. A statement that whenever they make it, tends to be followed by a customer horror story. We had planned on going to a home run layout. They talked us out of it. And now you know what wiring teaches us about plumbing. That the more you need to flow, the larger the diameter of what it should be flowing through. And if you can't replace it with something bigger, then divide and conquer by adding a second line and splitting the load. Get rid of resistance so you don't add slow where the water or the juice tries to go. And street smarts trump theoretical arguments. Next time, we'll talk about the roughly 35% of our basement that's home to an office and a TV studio, and how we managed to get good and agile lighting in place despite low ceilings, no drop ceiling, and a need for a single studio space to support multiple presentation stage sets. Wires and lights and, believe it or not, chains all have a role. We call the segment Stage Craftiness. You may find some ideas for your spaces from the tricks that we had to pull here. Be here in time for the curtain call.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer Club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Most of the computer clubs have begun to schedule their general monthly meetings through teleconferencing. For updated information, visit the website of the Computer Club for information how to join the meeting. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have a presentation on Network 101, installing the Internet of Things into your home or small business network, Thursday, September the 10th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting. Website is nyacc.org. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey has their meeting on Friday, September the 11th. Meeting time starts at 8 p.m. via Amazon Chime. Visit the website acgnj.org for more information on how to join the meeting. Princeton PC Users Group has their meeting on Tuesday, September the 22nd. Meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting, and their website is ppcug-nj.apcug.org. Let me repeat that. ppcug-nj.apcug.org. The Brookdale Computer User Group will have their meeting on Thursday, September the 24th. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting, and their website is bcug.com. Westchester PC Users Group. Presentation is web services. Meeting on Thursday, October the 1st, 2020 at 7 p.m. Remote attendance via Zoom video conference. Website is wpcug.org for meeting information. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the programs available on PRN.FM on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send me an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do your regular backups on your computer. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Marty Winston, and Benjamin Rockwell, we thank you for your support. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.